Hi everyone, and welcome to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han, and for today's episode I had the pleasure of talking to screen and playwright James Graham. He's responsible for some of the most successful political plays in recent years, which includes This House, about Labour's struggles in the 70s, which has just moved to West End, and Privacy, or Privacy, if you're weird, about the surveillance state, which features Daniel Radcliffe and was shown on Broadway. Now he's taken on the task of writing the screenplay for a TV drama about the Brexit campaign and referendum day, so I chatted to him about why Brexit makes such a great topic, and how he will try to be objective in his writing despite being a passionate Remainer. He also shares his views on how theatre can build bridges in our increasingly polarised society, so this is a really inspirational one. If you enjoy the show, please do rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice, because that's how people find out about us and it really helps us out. You can also find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. I want to jump right in with a compliment, because that's how we roll. You are one of the most prominent political playwrights in Britain at the moment. Where does this interest in politics come from? Have you always had it?
I think, weirdly, it mainly came from, I was obsessed at school about history, actually. I loved learning about history because I thought that it just presented me with the best stories, like any good narrative, any good play, TV, drama, or film. There's great characters going through great crises, and there's cause and effect. People make decisions, and they have huge consequences that you can see through to the end. So my passion for just gobbling up all the weird and wonderful moments of history, I think, accidentally almost led me onto politics and a discovery of all the different political orthodoxies that arrived during the 20th century. So I think that really, but I came from quite a political in the north of England, and actually confusing one, and it was in Nottinghamshire, and during the miners' strike in the 1980s, a few people will know, Nottingham had a kind of identity crisis over whether to strike or not strike, stuck between the Midlands and Yorkshire. So that conversation, I guess, was always around me growing up.
Mm. And I've noticed that I think a lot of writers incorporate political themes sort of indirectly. They're not very on the nose about it. It's not actually political settings. It's more referring to it through metaphors or little hints, whereas you seem to have always gone for literally bringing the political realm onto the stage. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I think you've hit on an interesting kind of question about what is political theatre, what is political drama. Is political theatre shows that take place within the political realm, in the corridors of power, or can you have a political drama set in someone's house, in someone's living room, without it necessarily being about politicians? But no, for whatever reason, as you get suddenly seduced by those people in power, and so mainly not even necessarily about the ideas, but about the processes, the rituals and the systems and the weird functions about how laws get passed and policy gets made. So in This House, which is just opened in the West End, it's set in Westminster in the 1970s, and it's not really about the big ideas of the 70s as the post-war consensus came to an end and Thatcher and Reagan were on the horizon. It's more about the weird and wonderful processes in that very old building, the House of Parliament, and how things get done. Because I just feel in a strange sort of way, if you want to understand the big stuff about politics, often you have to see the prism of the very tiny, weird minutiae of the day-to-day grind that is politics.
Yeah, and obviously the most sort of prominent example of you taking a political situation in a very realistic way is when the vote, which is, of course, about the last minutes of the general election, was actually broadcast during the last minutes of the actual general election, which is, I think, a bloody brilliant idea. Was that yours? Or
I wish I could take credit for it. No, but I've been working with a director called Josie Rourke at the Donmar Warehouse in London. We worked together on Privacy in New York, and it was her idea. We always wanted to do a play, I think, set on election night, but the whole concept of finding a way to broadcast a play live on television from the theatre on election night, that I think actually was the first play ever to be broadcast at the time in which it was set. So we set the play in the final 90 minutes of voting on the election in 2015, and that's the exact time in which it was broadcast. It was like it was live, and it was live. So, which meant that gloriously, as our play came down at 10 o'clock, that is since Brexit. But yeah, I'm a big believer in theatre and television drama stepping up and taking some of journalism's territory. Actually, when we think of election nights and those kind of things here and in the US, we think of them as being the sole preserve of pundits and academics and journalists to comment and make sense of it. And I don't know, it might sound incredibly arrogant or hubristic, but I think playwrights and dramatists are supposed to step up and, through storytelling, through drama, try and make sense of events almost as live as well.
So what do you think theatre can do there that journalists can't?
I just think with what art has always tried to do, which is a different kind of truth, which is a dangerous thing to say in this post-truth age, but I think that you know, facts and figures and an immediate response to something is, of course, vital for our functioning democracy. But what storytelling does is look at the human side of things, the emotional side of things, and try to get under the skin of it in a different way about how it feels to be possibly a presiding officer in a voting station or to be the Prime Minister as you lose a referendum. I think there's a different kind of insight that drama can penetrate, which possibly journalism can't.
Yeah. And shifting gears slightly to Brexit, what was your personal experience of the run-up to the referendum and referendum day and night itself?
Traumatic and confused, and it still remains so. I was actually in New York doing Privacy with Josie and starring Daniel Radcliffe. So we were in the rehearsal room from a daily basis doing a very political show about surveillance and the data and how data and social media affects our democracy. So I was kind of in it in my head. But honestly, I've been terrible, probably like everybody else, at predicting what might happen. So I'd fallen into a reasonable certainty that we would remain, but that it would be close. So, like everyone else, I was really surprised. I come from Leave in a way. My town up north, Mansfield, was one of the constituencies that voted most fully for Leave in the country. A lot of my family and a lot of my friends voted to Leave. So it's not. I wasn't isolated in my little playwrighty metropolitan bubble from those thoughts or ideas or that anger, but I still expected it not to happen. And then, I don't know, my main, I think, response in the days that followed was just despair, not that necessarily the decision made, but just that the chaos and the vacuum of any decent politician to step forward and provide a vision or an answer or hope. It felt like everyone kind of abandoned ship, and in most of my political dramas I try unfashionably to be quite optimistic and positive about politics and politicians, but in those few days I found the whole thing and the campaign generally incredibly toxic and riven by dirty personal stuff rather than it being about hope and about ideas and about a healthy conversation between two different sides. So devastated as a citizen just on the low quality of our political discourse, but I guess as a dramatist quite selfishly quite excited about the opportunity that it presented to get under the skin of it.
I'm quite curious, you just mentioned that people in your family and in your friend circle voted differently from you, and I think a lot of people had that experience. How have you personally dealt with that? Do you try not to talk about it? Is that your approach? Or do you try to listen to what they have to say and incorporate it into your view? Where do you fall on that?
I very consciously talk about it because one of the reasons why we're in the mess that we are across the world, in fact, is, as many people are discussing, there's a lack of conversation between two very polarised different sides now. And one of the reasons why the whole Leave campaign won, I think, is a feeling of half the country not being listened to or not being ignored. And that might be justified, that might be too simplistic an analysis, but I firmly believe, as a person and as a playwright, that two sides have to talk to each other. And it's a bit hard, and I'm only beginning that process, and as I go home for Christmas, I can't imagine it would be the easiest Christmas table as we unpick what happened. But I'm always of the belief that no one does things for the worst reasons or bad reasons. Everyone does things because they think it's the best thing to do, and we all come from different backgrounds with different baggage and have different lives, and so people make the choices that they do. So it's not, I won't apply judgment, even though I still feel very, I have an emotional response to this. But I think we have to listen, and I think, especially as I'm going to try and tackle it dramatically, it would be unfair and unreasonable not to try and get under the skin of some of those views that are different from mine.
Yeah. So what was it? This might be quite an obvious question. So was it that part, the polarization between these different sides, that made you want to write about it? Or is it, you know, the whole, you know, post-truth sentiment that was so instilled in these campaigns? Or was it the whole, you know, upper class versus working class thing? What was it exactly that was so interesting to you?
It's just a big combustible ball of all of the things you just said. It's the and it also is an opportunity, actually, very rarely do you get to use a domestic story that speaks quite globally. I think what is obviously happening here and in the US and across Europe, in Italy, France next year, possibly Germany, there's something's happening, and it's only just emerging, but obviously it's been bubbling away for a generation, this anti-establishment emotional desire to effect quite brutal change on the institutions and systems that we thought were quite sacrosanct. So it's all of that stuff. I mean, I think what's happening through journalism and social media and political conversation is really vital and really important to tackle. The idea that we are living, we are talking and conversing in different ways, and not across the board. We're talking to people who agree with us, and we're reading articles that confirm our own biases, which I think is incredibly devastating for democracy, and I think goes a long way to understanding what happened in June. I guess it's all that stuff. It's trying to, in a way, find a way to understand a sentiment, a mood, a feeling that is sweeping not just Britain, but the entire world.
Yeah. And this, you just mentioned that social media bubble sort of theorem that's been around quite a lot, what with the American election and Brexit. What do you think, is there anything people can actually do to counter that? Is it just actively searching out news sources that don't agree with their views, but then aren't people sort of naturally going to be inclined not to want to do that? How do you think, is it just holding Facebook accountable?
To me, it goes beyond just the algorithmic problems of these platforms, which are designed to deliver you what you want, whether that be a particular movie or a particular political party. And it even goes beyond our own personal responsibility towards seeking out views, articles, websites, opinions that go beyond our own. It's this huge, massive, combustible cultural crisis that I think we're entering, which is even, it's not even just the language that we're using now, which is more aggressive and more hostile to people who we oppose, partly because we're not used to meeting people we oppose anymore, because we're secluded in these enclaves online. I think we've actually just stopped talking, and not just online, but even face-to-face. There's a lot of people who I admire, mainly American psychoanalysts and sociologists, people like Sherry Turkle, who talk about a real crisis of conversation, whereby we neither have the language nor the means or the empathy anymore, partly because that conversation has transferred to digital platforms where we're anonymous and we're not face-to-face, which means that our nuance, the nuance of debate, the empathy of debate, the complexity of debate, the decency and tone and reason, and just the ability to listen, I think, is under severe threat. So how do we fix that? I don't know, really good question. I think partly we have to take responsibility to setting higher standards of our own conduct, whether that be face-to-face, whether that be at political rallies, whether that be online. I think you're right. I think we do have to seek out and try and understand with empathy and understanding other people's views. But I also do think there is a serious conversation to be had in the tech industry themselves and in wider journalism about their own culpability in the lowering of standards and discourse and conversation when it comes to politics. There's just so much anger. And if you look at the American election in particular, it wasn't even a debate. It was just shouting. It was just screaming. And there was just so much hate at a level I think is so dangerous and I'm frightened of it. So I guess I think drama and plays and films, and I'm biased obviously, but I think that has a huge role to play in getting different people and voices together into a space and safely exploring those views in a way that can be entertaining but also really has an important social function as well.
Do you think playwrights or screenwriters or authors then have a sort of responsibility to try and bridge that gap, or would you not go so far as to say that?
I would say so. I would hold myself responsible for having to step up based on the events that have happened this year. I just can't think of another way. Why else would I spend time doing what I'm doing if it wasn't in some way to try and contribute something to this thing, which I think is really important. So yeah, I wouldn't necessarily expect everybody or the playwrights, the artists, musicians, painters, writers, actors to feel the same level of responsibility, but I certainly do.
And are you currently, are you in the process of writing it? Are you done writing it? Where are you, if I can ask?
So it's kind of, I almost slightly kind of misspoke last week when this story got announced. I was just talking to a journalist about possibly writing a Brexit thing, which I'm sure comes as no surprise. I'm sure every playwright, political playwright in particular, is trying to tackle this subject. My thing, it's the details I can't give too much away yet, but it's actually going to be a television drama.
Okay. So
not something on stage. I think it'll be on screen. It's very early stages yet, but we have some good access to sources who are in both campaigns. And then imagining it's going to be kind of a single film that will try in some way to dramatize not just that campaign, but the wider things that you and I have been talking about.
Why did you want to do it on TV? Is it just to reach a broader audience that might not, you know, go to theatre in London? Is that the reasoning?
It's partly that. I'm very passionate about making sure that theatre has its role to play, especially because it's the last live spaces that we have where you get people together in the physical space, and I will always think that that's one of the most effective ways to explore difficult political issues. Going back to my face-to-face theory, that I think you need to your physical space and getting people in it together is vital to unlocking some of the hostility between people around this stuff. But no, you're right. Ultimately, of course, television has a wider reach in the first instance. And I'm a big believer in State of the Nation drama, State of the Nation television. Again, as per the vote, that it being a story, a piece of drama that in some way tries to make sense of what is happening as opposed to journalism.
And you mentioned earlier that you think it's quite important to be fair and balanced in that representation. And obviously, as a Remainer, I don't know if you think that might be tough, but I'm curious how you want to counter that. Are you doing some research? Are you talking to different people about it to get their experience, or what's your process there?
Yeah, exactly that. Just talking to as many different people on both sides as possible. And you're right to identify the challenge, and I enjoy it as a challenge, but it is a challenge whereby you have to accept that you have your own bias, you have your own prejudices. I approached it a particular way. Referendums, you have to. It's a false binary, and that's the problem with referendums, but it makes you pick either this extreme. And so I had to pick one, and I did. But I think as long as you're conscious of your bias, and you try where to play people's advocate with it and to fight against that, that is my responsibility now, and that's what I intend to do. Partly also because it just makes interesting drama. Nobody wants to be lectured at by a lefty metropolitan liberal player right about the mistake they made voting Leave. That's so boring. So yes, it's my responsibility to make sure that all these are kind of represented as fairly as possible.
And, yeah, I know you've already said that you can't give anything away, but could you give any hint about anything at all? Or is it all massively under wraps?
It's not even being secretive, really. It's just because I'm literally going to be starting it in a couple of weeks' time. So I'm doing a lot of reading and interviewing, but I'm not quite sure yet what form it will emerge. I know that the campaign itself and the night in question, as a result, I think that will play a key strand in the centre of the drama as what felt impossible and implausible about 9 p.m. on June the 23rd suddenly became clearly possible, and the ground shifts and the peak that moment where drama really excites and thrills when history's about to change and you just catch people in the middle of that as the two sides start to pull apart. I think that's such an exciting and fertile territory for drama, so that would definitely be playing a part in it.
And what kinds of people are you interviewing? Is it more sort of regular people, or is it people who campaigned, politicians, things like that?
Yeah, probably so. It'll be people who ran the campaigns on both sides, and the campaigners and the politicians who supported one side or the other. There's a Shakespearean quality to some of the stories of those people. I'm sure you can guess who I'm thinking of. People like Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, the journey they went on through that campaign to their ultimate, well, depends, discuss, but the ultimate destruction at the end is you know, classic high theatre. So that's, yes, also I will be trying to make it, bring it down from the lofty corridors of Westminster into the high streets and normal people who will be the most affected by the decision that we made.
So is Boris Johnson going to feature? And if yes, who do you want to play him?
I can't guarantee that he will, because I just haven't put my finger to keypad yet, but I relish the opportunity to try and write something with him in it, yes. And God, as for the actor who might play him, I've got no idea. If you have any ideas, please feel free to suggest them.
I wish I had a witty suggestion, but I really don't. I think I'm stumped.
All I can think about is the wig department are going to be very busy getting that right, apart from that.
What do you think they're going to use to make it? Straw, maybe?
Straw, hay, but no idea. Who's the next person?
We're really just... No, this is too much of an overused subject. We shouldn't make fun of his hair. No, that's too easy. Moving
enough.
On.
There are other things to make fun of him about, believe me, so let's, yeah.
So your play, This House, as I mentioned, about the struggles of the Labour government in the 70s, which has been massively successful and is now moving to the West End, you've said that you think it's now still very poignant, if not even more poignant, in light of sort of a post-referendum Britain. Why do you think that is?
Well, the 70s were time, again, 74, 79, we begin in 1974, when the didn't quite get a majority, which meant the next 4 years was just a constant struggle in the House of Commons for the whips, who had to shepherd every single one of their sick and ailing and difficult and dying members into the lobby, and that even then that wasn't enough votes to pass anything. They had to do deals and make difficult decisions with their opponents on the other side of the aisle just to get anything done. So it's high drama, but I think the 70s generally represents much less going through now, a kind of ideological crossroads in this country and the world. The political obviously that had survived between both major parties since the end of the war was starting to crumble. This is that even though there's difference of opinions on specific policies, there was a general understanding of the direction of the country, a mixed economy, violent public, and a general understanding about the nature of what the Britain should be. As that began to collapse, and a new idea and the emergence of Thatcher and monetarism and the end of socialism, as was going to be the fight, it emerged. I think it's just very rich ground for a playwright, but it also helps make sense of what's happening now as we emerge with Trump, as we emerge with a Europe that might not survive the next 12 months, as we emerge with Britain taking a huge radical step into the unknown for its future. It feels like we're in a gap, a void, whereby one idea is ending and a new idea, whatever that is about to start. And within that gap, again, is always great drama. So I think our audiences feel that sense of chaos and that sense of danger, even though it's ostensibly, I guess, a comedy, it's quite light and there's lots of farce elements in it, because politics is farcical. I also think they must see, it's completely accidental, I didn't predict anything, I'm not a genius, I just told the script was. And for whatever reason, it's come to a lot in 2016. There are stories about the Labour Party tearing itself apart. Is it struggles to find its direction? Does it go hard left or does it go hard right? What's more important, electability or socialist integrity? Those debates happened in the 1970s in my play, and they're happening now. So I think people enjoy drawing us out to what's happening today.
Does that make you feel like everything's a bit futile, like we're stuck in this endless, like, political vicious cycle where everything's doomed to repeat itself?
God, yeah. put it better myself. There is, everyone comes up to me going, oh, it's amazing how so relevant it is now, and I wish I could reply positively, but actually, no, I do find it depressing that we get stuck in these fatalistic cycles that, I mean, possibly there's a, I don't know, sometimes I think, is there a reassurance to that even in dark and difficult times, which I would absolutely describe as being now, that therefore we must know that we will find ourselves out of it again, and for every up there's a down. So maybe there's a positivity to it, but I think it's just in human nature that we forget the mistakes of the past. We repeat, fail, try again, repeat, fail, try again. And actually no new ideas are ever really new. They've always been tried before.
Wow, this got really existential.
I know. Gosh, I'm going to go and have a drink after this.
It's only, you know, midday. It's fine.
Yeah, but I'm a playwright. People expect me to be having a whiskey at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
It's fine. We'll go with it. So now that I think, at least to me, it seems like Brexit is permeating everything. Do you think there's a danger that the average person just kind of gets fatigued with hearing about this whole ordeal all the time, and then they stop caring about this issue, which is obviously going to shape all of our futures?
100%. And I think, again, going back to the low quality political discourse that we have now, I think partly maybe that's even a conscious or at least unconscious objective by the politicians running the show, that it's so obscured by this incredibly vacuous language of hard Brexit, soft Brexit, black, grey and white Brexit. The new one yesterday from Theresa May was red, white and blue. All these things which don't really mean anything. It's tedious and it's boring, and maybe that is the point. The point is clearly the desire of this government, and hence why they're currently fighting the Supreme Court to deny its transparency in Parliament. It's just to do it behind the scenes, to do it backstage, an outer view of the public, which I think is really dangerous. But I can absolutely see the average guy or girl on the streets going, God, do you know what, we voted this particular way, just get it. And again, I have to constantly ask what role writers and playwrights have in making sure that this subject, this story, is constantly in focus and also accessible in a human way, in an entertaining way, so that it doesn't suddenly feel completely beyond us, which I'm sure in certain quarters of government is almost the point.
So in a completely non-self-serving way, you reckon the solution to Brexit fatigue is going to the theatre?
I'd love that to be the case. I'd never suggest that as being the sole chance of our survival. But I think it certainly plays a part. I'm realistic in thinking that can a play ever change the world? I would never say that, but I think an accumulation of things that can contribute to a conversation and to a mass accumulation of art and work and ideas that can, of course, change things, and that's why we do it. So I would chuck in my bit into the soup and hope that it sticks to somebody.
As always, thanks for listening, and if you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode, and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.